I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
The aliens enjoy music, all types of music, especially ancient Tibetan style music.
We ask about their diet.
They do eat vegetables. They like vegetables. And their favorite dish or snack is ice cream, especially strawberry.
What? What you just heard was an infamously ridiculous clip from the 1980s television special UFO Cover-Up Live, in which an alleged shadowy government insider known only as Falcon blew the whistle on what the government didn't want you to know about the extraterrestrial presence on Earth, which apparently included some aliens have a liking for strawberry ice cream. Yeah, I know, it's completely bonkers and ludicrous. Bear with me though, I'm not gonna go full crazy coast to coast AM caller on you. It turns out the highly distorted voice in that clip belonged to a fellow by the name of Richard Doty, a special agent for the United States Air Force Office of Special Investigations. Now, assuming I haven't lost you already with all the talk of little green men, Doty is where it gets interesting, because, you see, he was one of the primary players in a disinformation campaign targeting a UFO hobbyist by the name of Paul Benowitz. Benowitz was snooping around Kirtland Air Force Base, and needless to say, that did not make the brass at Kirtland very happy. Although that may not have had anything to do with UFOs. In any case, after being fed a steady diet of disinformation, Benowitz reached ever-escalating heights of paranoia, eventually leading to a proverbial dive off the psychological cliff into utter madness, culminating in his institutionalization. The legacy of the Benowitz affair forms the foundation of modern UFO myth. Conspiracies about US government deals with aliens, malevolent extraterrestrials experimenting on human subjects in underground bases, and all other sorts of tall tales, recycled and reiterated over the years by a variety of eccentrics at the kookiest ends of the UFO subculture, as well as some characters like Doty from a more, shall we say, cloak and dagger background. Joining us on this edition of the program to unpack this strange saga and how it may relate to current hot topics like fake news and the rise of QAnon are Adam Gorightly, author of the new book Saucers, Spooks, and Kooks: UFO Disinformation in the Age of Aquarius, and David Perkins, who provides the foreword to said book. If you're expecting a conversation trying to sell you on ideas like shape-shifting reptilian aliens eating your babies, well, I think you're going to be disappointed. But I think the story you're about to hear is much more interesting than anything you could read in a David Icke book. And with that being said, let's get right to the conversation with Adam Gurightly and David Perkins. Welcome to Parallax Views. Adam Gurightly, the crackpot historian, I think that's a self-description there, and author of Saucers, Spooks, and Kooks, UFO Disinformation in the Age of Aquarius, and also joining us, David Perkins, who wrote the foreword for this very interesting book. How are both of you doing today?
Great. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, doing fine. Thanks. Thanks for having us.
So I guess the place I want to begin, I really haven't covered the sort of UFO subculture on my show. I think some people are like, oh, UFOs, that, you know, they probably say what you see in the title of your book, Adam. They'll say, oh, that sounds like kooks and kookiness. But I think this is a really interesting book that has an appeal outside of even UFO subculture. While I was reading this, I was thinking about phenomena like QAnon, a lot of the talk we have now about intelligence agencies, whether it be Russia or the US, sort of being involved in social media and pushing certain narratives. I think there is a way that the story you tell in Saucers, Spooks, and Kooks relates to a lot of phenomena we're seeing today that may not even be related to the whole UFO subculture. Would you agree with that?
I would, yes.
So I guess going from there, how would you sum up Saucers, Spooks, and Kooks, and how did it come about, this project of looking into the sort of history of the modern UFO myth and maybe how that myth was manipulated in some ways?
Well, it's been a long journey for sure. You know, many, many years I was involved in the UFO conspiracy scene, you know, different networks through reading and writing for zines. And then, you know, with the early, early days of the internet with bulletin boards and news groups, I was exposed to a lot of these, call them mythos about ETs and various conspiracies around ETs, you know. So I encountered a lot of this stuff back in the day, and in recent years, you know, I became more curious about where did these stories come from. You know, there's a lot of them that in UFO lore that seem to tell the same stories, you know, from a little different angles. Like a recurring one is a battle between the U.S. government and aliens in an underground base. And this supposedly occurred at the Dulce base, which we'll get into. But there's also stories about the same type of thing happening at Area 51. So part of my interest and intent in writing this book was to look into all these different mythos and stories and separate, you know, the fact from fiction and look where they came from and see how they evolved over time.
Real quickly there too, I want to say a lot of that mythology had a real impact on pop culture too. I mean, people don't realize it necessarily unless they're familiar with it, but the X-Files, a lot of what you see in a show like the X-Files in the 90s is taken from a lot of this UFO research subculture community, is it not?
Oh, most definitely. And a lot of it seems, you know, as far as what appeared on X-Files, a lot of that came out of the Dulce Base story. And before that, you know, the Paul Benowitz affair. And, you know, those were huge influences on the X-Files and, you know, that the pop culture of really the early 19 to mid 1990s, where you saw a lot of these themes about aliens and underground bases, a secret pact with the government, an alien hybrid, alien-human hybrid breeding program, aliens in cahoots with the U.S. Government. All this stuff later, in one form or another, reared its head in the X-Files for sure.
Now, if you could, Adam, and I want to kick this over to David after we ask this question. For my listeners that may be unfamiliar, what is the Dulce base? This rather pulpish sort of part of UFO lore.
The Dulce base, just the basic story behind it, or the mythology, is that sometime starting in the late 70s, there was a secret pact between the U.S. government and aliens, in this case, white Draco reptilians, as some stories go. And there's also stories of alien grays and different entities being at this Dulce underground base. But in the 70s, there was this pact between the U.S. government and aliens, and an arrangement, a treaty, have you, that the aliens would exchange secret technology in return for humans to experiment upon. And this was all supposedly going on at the Dulce base, which is allegedly located in New Mexico, near the Jicarilla Reservation. So there was, as the story goes, there were humans collaborating with aliens at this Dulce base underground facility. And at one point, there was a revolt, and the humans there, with a few of the aliens who joined their resistance, decided they were going to blow the whistle on what was going on with all these ghastly experiments on humans that were going on. And there was
real quick, what do they call it? Isn't part of the lore, there's this idea that there's a nightmare room within the base, or a nightmare level?
Yeah, there's seven levels, and the ghastliest of them all is what's called Nightmare Hall, where all these experiments go on with hybrid humans and aliens. And also there's stories they were creating, some animals as well were involved. And that's also the whole cattle mutilation mythos kind of intersects with the Dulce story. So that's where all the horrific things were going on. And that led to this revolt and what was called the so-called Dulce War that supposedly happened in 1979, with a security worker there at Dulce Base, whose name was allegedly Thomas Castello, helped lead this revolt where 66 humans died. And luckily, Castello had what was called a flash gun, which was a pretty kick-ass weapon, according to accounts. And he was able to escape with videotapes and photos and other evidence related to Dulce Base. That's kind of the basic story there of the Dulce mythos, which, as I kind of detail in the book, it's, you know, there's a mix of fact and fiction with this legend, as there is with a lot of the stories in ufology. And, you know, that's a good way of propagating these type of mythos or conspiracy theories, is to have a grain of truth or fact in them mixed with all the other misinformation or disinformation.
I was going to add to that as well. We'll get into the disinformation and the misinformation, but how much of this can be chalked up to maybe just, I don't know how to put this in a nice way, but some of the characters that come up in the book, I'm particularly thinking of a fellow by the name of Phil Schneider, who claimed to have worked at the Dulce base. I feel as if there may have been other things going on rather than disinformation or misinformation with a person like Schneider, who I think it can be said probably had delusions or just mental health issues. How much does that play a role in maybe the mythology around a lot of this UFO lore?
Well, that's where the kooks come into the story. You know, within the wild and woolly world of ufology, there's different elements. There's people who are quote-unquote serious researchers. There's those who propagate intentionally disinformation or without knowing misinformation. And there's the people who are involved in this world, that there's a segment who are mentally imbalanced. And, you know, it basically the belief of, you know, these type of mythologies, belief systems are what helps in many cases drive somebody who is kind of somewhat leaning towards mental instability. These type of belief systems push people over the edge. And in the case of Phil Schneider, that seemed to be the case. Schneider latched on to the theory or promoted the idea that he was like Thomas Castello. In fact, the story he propagated in the mid-90s appeared to be taken directly from the Thomas Castello narrative. Schneider claimed that he had worked as a geologist instead of a security worker. He was a geologist, according to his story, and who stumbled into this Dulce War battle. And once again, was on the lecture circuit in the mid-90s, telling his story, how he had encountered aliens, how they used a laser to shoot off his fingers and created a chest scar that he would show people during his various lectures. It was later discovered, as I document in the book, Schneider had a long history of mental instability and was a self-mutilator, which accounted for his missing fingers and his chest scar.
I want to stick on one point here with Phil Schneider. You mentioned there's this UFO lecture circuit, and I believe Schneider was on that lecture circuit in, you know, probably the early 90s. I want to say early 90s, not late 80s, but around that time. What's really interesting to me, and one way this connects to a lot of the issues we see in our culture today, is around this time where people like Phil Schneider are doing the lecture circuit, the UFO sort of subculture goes from just being about UFO sightings and an interest in finding out what these sightings are about to overlapping with, I would say, pretty far-right political movements, what's known as the Patriot Movement in the 1990s, that, you know, ultimately involved things like militias and sort of these really extreme Tim McVeigh characters. What can you say about that crossover between maybe the far right and the UFO subculture in the 90s? Do you think the Dulce base mythology is part of that?
Oh, it was definitely part of that. It got picked up by the likes of William Cooper, for instance, and guys like Anthony Hilder, who were associated with the right wing and militias. And part of it, you know, it was the anti-government stance of, you know, that was the same period that a lot of people were going out to Area 51. And they were, you know, demanding access to the bases, as you heard those confrontations back in the day with WAC and HUT and security forces. So it played into a larger narrative where the government was hiding the truth from the American people. And so the likes of Bill Cooper and Anthony Hilder and Norio Hayakawa was also involved in that scene back in the day. They did indeed create this overlap within ufology and call it, you know, the New World Order conspiracies. And that's, you know, you often talk about that middle area where you might have people who are just dope smoking, perhaps more left-leaning people who believe in the existence of UFOs and ETs, connecting with some of those folks on the right wing. And, you know, that area in between is called fusion paranoia, where you can bring opposite sides of the political spectrum together in the battle against whoever that perceived enemy may be, the New World Order conspirators, the Illuminati, etc.
So, David, I failed to bring you in sooner into this conversation. I guess where I want to bring you in is, how do you sort of become involved in this story of the Dole Space, or at least what were you researching that led you to working with Adam on this book and providing some information to him and writing the foreword?
Okay. I think Adam and I were aware of each other for quite some time because we work in the same circles. And I guess it was a couple of years ago, our mutual friend, Greg Bishop, sort of said, you guys ought to get together. I guess that's when Adam was starting his book. Because I had been involved with this material since 1975, actually, way back. And I got into it as a cattle mutilation investigator in Colorado. And that was because that was the big story in Colorado in 1975, the greatest outrage in the history of the cattle industry, as the governor called it at the time. So it was a big deal. And I was right there in the middle of it. And I was, at that time, I was sort of had a romantic image of being a, you know, investigative reporter. It was the days after Watergate. And that was, seemed like a really exciting realm to be in. And
Real quick, David.
Yeah.
When you say that you were investigating cattle mutilations, this is like at a really early point in, you know, the, how do I put it? This is before cattle mutilations, before people get the image in their head of, you know, UFOs beaming up herds of cows. This is, no one really knows what's going on with it at this point that you're speaking of, right?
This is true. And 1975 was a seminal year when all this really broke loose into the national consciousness, I would say, because it was happening all over the country.
And a lot of ranchers were being affected by it.
Oh, yeah. We're talking hundreds, thousands of cases. And it was making the mainstream media. It started gradually working in stories in Newsweek and elsewhere that said, well, what's going on out there? Boy, this is kind of weird. And then at the time, it was the axiom was saucers, Satanist, or CIA, right? That was the catchy phrase. Okay, those are the three suspects. It's either aliens, or it's a government program of some sort, or it's a satanic cult at work. So these three were battling it out in the media. And it sold a lot of newspapers, let's put it that way. But it was still slightly below the radar of most people. And even to this day, there are people I talk to, that, and I mentioned, they have no idea what I'm talking about. So it hasn't totally permeated the culture. But at that time, especially in the West, in the Southwest, it was a very big story. So I was right in the middle of it, and I was saying, okay, I'm looking for a good investigative journalist project here. Now, I'll figure this one out. I'm going to solve this. And no matter what it takes, I'm going to solve this. And I'll have fame and glory. But... so I was a bit ego driven there, but you know, once I got sucked into it, then it was like, oh, I really want to know what this is. What the heck is going on here? None of my theories worked. None of them seemed adequate. Nobody's theory seemed adequate. And 45 years later, I'm sitting here talking to you guys and I still don't know what it is. But I know it's important. That's one thing I'm just convinced that there's something really important behind it. And the way it segues into Adam's story, the mutilations played a pretty major role in this whole mythos. Back to the Dulce, that's how you pronounce it, by the way, Dulce. the Dulce myth, it was central to that story. But it wasn't just happening there. It was happening all over the country. I think Adam was trying to narrow it down to generally talk about it in relation, the mutilations, that is, in relationship to the Dulce story. But this story was being repeated over and over and over, with helicopters and UFOs flying around and all kinds of other attendant odd anomalous events. It's just a tale of lunacy. I say that in the foreword. But I hope we don't lose any of your listeners thinking that this is a UFO story, because I think, JG, you framed it really nicely at the very beginning, saying this, what we're really looking at here is sort of an origin myth of the modern conspiracy culture, which has manifested itself now as QAnon, right, which is in Congress. You know, so it hasn't exactly gone away. But what thrilled me so much about Adam's research, and why we started hooking up about a couple of years ago, I guess, was I saw the potential for understanding the social engineering aspect of the mutilations and the UFO phenomenon itself. What's so wonderful about what Adam has done here is he's taken that story into its most granular terms, to every moving part of this story, how a myth like this is born and then manipulated and pervade through the culture. So that's why I think it's important for everybody to pay attention to what he has to say here and not just tune us out thinking, oh, it's more UFO stories about shootouts with aliens and such nonsense. But it's just a whole lot more to it. And I think by understanding the way Adam has laid this out, it gives you a really clear picture of how this kind of thing can develop and fester, I'd call it, in the culture, because he gets every nut and bolt. I mean, he just lays it out, and he resists the urge to do what I did in the foreword, which was to kind of frame it in a social engineering context, basically. But there's a lot more to it than even that, because behind all of this is still an unexplained phenomenon. So I'm still in the chase, and I'm just very, like I say, grateful to Adam for taking the time and effort to put this whole thing together in a very tidy way for anybody to look at and understand and see how we got to where we're at right now with something like QAnon.
I think that's a great way to look at this as well. You know, looking at the development of this sort of conspiratorial mythology around UFOs, and then how that seeps over into Patriot Movement, and how now maybe a lot of that has seeped over into QAnon. And I think there is a real body count, in a way, to this type of phenomena, whether we want to call it social engineering or sort of manipulation of dupes or naive people. And that sort of brings me to a key figure who I think, regardless of what one thinks of UFOs, the story of Paul Benowitz and the Benowitz Affair is a really, really chilling one that I think should interest just about anyone. It's a very tragic human interest story, in my view. Adam, could you tell my listeners who Paul Benowitz was?
Yeah, so Paul Benowitz was a physicist and scientist, inventor, contractor with the military, who lived at the time in the late 70s adjacent to Kirtland Air Force Base in New Mexico, where a lot of strangeness was going on. And Benowitz, he had, besides
now, real quick, Kirtland, there was, I think, the largest cache of nuclear weapons there at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's part of the Benowitz story. He, besides his professional career, he also already had an interest in UFOs as well as cattle mutilations. And since he lived adjacent to Kirtland, he was often looking around the base and happened upon UFOs showing up there now and then. So he started filming UFOs and taking photographs, and also set up a pretty sophisticated system for picking up electromagnetic signals and whatnot, and filmed some UFOs over this area we just mentioned, the Monsanto's weapons area, which has existed within Kirtland Base and was the largest cache for nuclear weapons during that period. So Benowitz became alarmed at what he was filming and some of the signals and whatnot he started picking up. So he alerted the security there at Kirtland Base, had a meeting with them, and hoped to work with them on solving this problem, which he considered one of national security. Like I said, the security there did meet with him, the Air Force security, and heard him out, heard what he had to say, but didn't seem to be taking him seriously at the time. And so he kind of escalated this and started contacting different political representatives, a couple senators, U.S. senators, Pete Domenici, and what was the Schmidt?
Harrison Schmidt.
As well as even firing off letters to Ronald Reagan to bring this to the attention of, that this was pretty sketchy what was going on there. And, you talk about, you look at the QAnon and a lot of these stories. It occurred to me a common theme that you've seen play out is the whistleblower throughout ufology and in, various conspiracy stories. Benowitz was a true whistleblower, as a lot of this mythology evolved over time. You started having fake whistleblowers like Thomas Castello, who I mentioned before. He was basically a creation. So, that's a common theme you see in a lot of these stories.
Well, real quick here. So what's interesting is Benowitz is going all over the place talking about this Air Force base. And I'm assuming the brass at the Air Force base is like, this dude is now meddling in our affairs. And none of this may have to do with UFOs. It may have to do with just like, we can't have this guy running around possibly compromising national security. We don't even know who all he is talking to. What if he's talking to people that are spies for foreign governments? I'm assuming that may be what's going on with Kirtland, right?
Yeah, and that's how the notorious character of Richard Doty became involved, who was a AFOSI agent, Air Force Office of Special Investigations, and he was, quote, put on the case and started interacting with Benowitz. And basically, for a lot of his communications, he used a liaison by the name of William Moore, who was a writer, budding ufologist. And as the story goes, Moore at one point was approached by a mysterious character named Falcon, an intelligence agent of some sort, who put him in touch with Doty. And they started kind of working together. And the arrangement that Moore had with Falcon and Doty was that they would pass on to him top secret UFO intelligence coming out of the government. And Moore would, in return, basically infiltrate ufology, kind of keep track on the different players in the ufology research circles, a lot of whom at that time were civilian contractors working on like the stealth projects and different secret projects going on during that period. So that seemed to be a lot of the interest, not so much UFOs, but these people who worked in were also involved in UFO circles and also as civilian contractors. What might information, secret information, might they be passing on to a lot of the perhaps foreign nationals or others that were basically themselves infiltrating ufology? So it created this whole situation of kind of a spy versus spy type of thing. And part of the modus operandi of Doty, who was running this counterintelligence program
for Air Force intelligence,
yes, was to pass on. He would, as the as I've been, you know, discovered over time, a certain amount of the information he would pass on, you know, was factual information about some of the programs, but mixed in with this was a lot of misinformation, disinformation regarding UFOs and ETs. And as you suggested, AFOSI became concerned because what Benowitz was picking up on was the testing of, in some cases, stealth technology, and these signals he was picking up was like this secret program they used, were working on at that time to communicate with satellites. So, you know, they were concerned that he'd pass on this information to our adversaries. So part of the counterintelligence program aimed at him and other ufologists was just to kind of like poison the well and confuse them and perhaps even discredit them. And so they started passing on this information to Paul Benowitz concerning aliens what the Benowitz was filming and photographing and seeing were hostile ETs. And once again, you know, what was the motive behind this? You could point at several: to discredit him, to also to have him pass get information and pass it on to other contacts to see who Benowitz himself was interacting, if he was interacting with foreign agents.
Now, real quick here, and you can correct me on any of this because my memory on it is a little hazy, but Benowitz also got some type of, I don't know if it was like a computer program or some software that he thought had alien languages on it. And yeah, this really illustrates this whole Benowitz affair is really sad because, I mean, if people haven't figured out by now, Benowitz basically is driven off the cliff of the Chapel Perilous. I mean, he goes crazy. Tell us a little bit about this computer program and just how much all of this sort of disinformation and counterintelligence causes Benowitz to take a dive off the deep end, so to speak.
Yeah, that is really one of the odd stories. According to Bill Moore, this is this is a couple of years that it passed. Bill Moore had been working with Doty and feeding information to Benowitz, and at one point Moore was having a conversation with J. Allen Hynek, who is famous for his work with Project Blue Book. He's kind of a famous ufologist. And over adult beverages one evening, Hynek allegedly claimed that he had passed on a computer to Paul Benowitz that included a software in it that would allow him, Benowitz, to communicate with the ETs. Now, this has been confirmed, at least to the extent that he did have a computer and he was talking to or thought he was talking to ETs and receiving images of what these ETs look like over this computer. Other folks had visited Benowitz and seen him operating this computer, such as Gabe Valdez, a kind of famous cattle mutilation researcher, and Richard Doty as well. And so, you know, this was once again just another method of disinforming Benowitz or creating this false belief system of the ETs invading the Earth. And it became his mission to thwart the ETs, and he wrote up the famous report that he had was sending out to all these politicians called Project Beta, where he was outlining his grand plan to basically thwart the ETs. And he had even created what he called a, or what people referred to as a space gun that would allow him to defeat the ETs. And all of this later kind of transformed into the greater Dulce base mythology with Thomas Costello and his so-called flash gun. And Benowitz also came across information in the late 70s, early 80s about that there had been some type of confrontation at Dulce Base. All of these little tidbits of stuff that Benowitz thought he was information that he thought he had figured out later wove itself into the greater Dulce Base story or mythos.
And with the question of mental deterioration, there was a really psychological impact that this all had on Benowitz.
Oh yeah, he eventually, you know, the really heady days was like from 79 to 84 when he was involved in all of this stuff. And he started slowly to move away from ufology. But, you know, people around that mid-80s period, ufologists became more and more aware of his story and were seeking him out. And eventually, all these interactions led to him being committed to a facility by his own family for a period of time because he basically went off the deep end, thought that aliens were breaking into his house or MIBs or what have you and shooting up him up with drugs. And so, it did eventually drive him over the deep end.
Now, just to be clear here, there is some question as to whether a lot of what Richard Doty did with this disinformation sort of campaign, how much of it was him stepping over the line and doing more than he was really expected mm-hmm. to or told to, and how much of it was, you know, he had the full green light, correct?
Yeah, and that's what we don't know for sure. And I mean, that's typical of Spook World with the various intelligence agencies never get the full story. I mean, some say that Doty became a rogue agent to a certain extent, feeding him all the ET information. But, you know, that in itself could be a cover story that the government could use to distance themselves from a disinformation or counterintelligence program. So you never quite get the full story. And I'm not even sure myself where the counterintelligence program against Benowitz and other ufologists ended and where, you know, just somebody who wanted to play pranks on people and kind of got out of beyond what he was directed to do by his superiors by, you know, feeding all this ET information to Benowitz and driving him off the deep end.
Now, I want to get back to Doty in a second because for some reason, despite all of this, he still keeps popping up even yep. after this whole Benowitz affair unravels. But I mm-hmm. guess first we have to talk about how did the Benowitz affair and maybe this disinformation campaign or various disinformation campaigns come to light? And I think the best answer for that is a little conference, a UFO conference. I believe it's run by MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, that had as one of its speakers the previously mentioned Bill Moore, who sort of became famous for his work on Roswell, sort of along with Stanton Friedman bringing the Roswell case back to life after many years of it just being really obscure. But at that conference, and we'll get into this in more detail later, but at that conference, Bill Moore caused a bit of an uproar when he spoke about the issue of disinformation and infiltration of this sort of UFO subculture.
David was actually at the conference.
David, would you like to comment on it?
Sure. I was at that conference, and I like Greg Bishop's description of it. He was there, too. He said it was the best lecture he'd ever seen anywhere, anytime. Not necessarily for the content of the lecture, but for the response of the audience, because
Members screaming, "I'm going to go get a fire hose." There was other members screaming, "Well, what about the Constitution?"
Well, I was just thinking that in one of the tapes of the conference, you could hear me groaning. I let out a really loud groan, and that was actually when Bill Cooper got up and said that the chauffeur driver for Kennedy was the one that actually turned around and shot him. And this was, you know, this was right before Moore, I can't remember which, but... And I think the whole audience groaned, but I could hear myself groaning. It's like, oh, come on. it was a wild affair. And people were screaming, what right do you have to drive people crazy just because you want to know more about UFOs? Which kind of boils down the sentiment of the whole thing. It was a real turning point in ufology, because that's what I'm working on these days, and it's why I'm working on the computer, the Hynek loaded computer story. I've been working on that for the last couple of weeks, and I think I can present a convincing case that Hynek did indeed present a loaded computer to Benowitz. And to me, I'm looking for these points of where ufology went to the dark side, right? That it was no longer the Space Brothers and utopian visions of, you know, our future with the friendly, lovely aliens, but it became dark and awful, really. You know, vats of human body parts floating, in the Dulce base. But if I may, I'd like to just, I realize that when we talk about cattle mutilations, I don't know if people are really aware what that means, but just encapsulated, it's a phenomenon that started back as, say, 1967 is where we started from, with Snippy the horse in the San Luis Valley, who was found very mysteriously, I say cut up, was certainly what it looks like. But in a classic, what we call a classic cattle mutilation, the rectum is cored out, the genitals are missing, there's generally an eye is missing, an ear is cut off, the tongue is cut out. I use these words cut because that's what it seems to be. Some people think it's lasers. So what it looked to me from the very beginning as if something was being tested. It looked like a scientific test. My, you know, young investigative days, I was thinking this is a biowarfare test of some sort. The government's out there testing means and methods of doing something like that in the first place with helicopters, and secondly, of trying to determine the effects of various biowarfare agents on living beings, just, you know, cows in this instance. And I should point out that the cattle mutilations are still happening to this day. You know, just last week, we got new cases from Oregon. Oregon has been the hot spot for this lately. So this hasn't gone away. It's still among us. And NPR got a bunch of flack recently because they put on a nationwide NPR one of the cattle mutilation stories that came out of Oregon, and they got a tremendous blowback. It's like, why are you airing this crap? This is nonsense and aliens and all this stuff. They weren't saying it was aliens out there. The law enforcement and the vets were just saying, this is mysterious. We don't know what did it. That's all they would say. Some of them jumped in with the satanic cult business, and there was quite a stir with that for a while. But I just thought the listener should be aware that this is something that's still ongoing, still unresolved. And in the case of Dulce, I was so interested in it because, as Adam writes in his book, there was a nuclear detonation in 1967, 20 miles away from Dulce, upwind, called Gas Buggy, in which they set off a humongous nuclear explosion underground. It was like the earliest fracking, right, to try to liberate these gases to be able to capture them and sell them or whatever, which was insane when you think about it. And it was the gas was unusable. Everything was polluted. Supposedly, the cancer rates in Dulce went up among the Jicarilla Indian tribe. And so this is what drew me to Dulce back in the 70s. It's like, I want to see what's going on with this. This was before really the Benowitz stuff ever hit. But it seemed to me like something was being tested. It was quite possibly the extent of contamination from nuclear facilities of various sorts. I had mapped out all the places where the mutations happened. They seemed to center around nuclear areas, either anywhere in the nuclear chain, from uranium mining to nuclear weapons testing.
So in other words, maybe I didn't mean to interrupt you. So in other words, maybe these mutilations had to do with maybe testing radiation levels.
Well, that's what I was after. That was my theory. And it's still a theory that I looked at, and it seems to, in many cases, hold up, in other cases, not so much, just like most theories. But it still seems to have some sort of resonance. And if you look at the UFO phenomenon, say, I don't know, as far back as you want to go, there has been some sort of, correlation between so-called UFO sightings and nuclear facilities. And this goes back to also in 1975 when the mutilations were at their peak, when we had the so-called overflights of the Northern Tier SAC bases, which is still one of the most puzzling things I've ever come across, because a lot of documents were released that confirmed that there had been intrusions into this, I guess it was five different bases along the Northern Tier of the United States. And I was at that time filing FOIA documents trying to get the information on what was going on, because those same areas were having cattle mutilations. So that's where I was saying it. Dulce is not really a standalone item, that these things cluster together. The phenomena seem to cluster in a way that seems significant.
Well, I was going to add to that real quick if I could. Yeah. I mean, when we look at something even like Area 51, people often forget that there was a case against the U.S. federal government involving Area 51, I believe in the 90s, I want to say, where workers were getting sick. And I always found it interesting that at the same time you have, this issue of workers getting sick at Area 51 due to possible contamination, you have the Bob Lazar and UFOs being back engineered at Area 51 story coming up. And, you know, I guess this is kind of speculative and conspiratorial in itself, but, and cue the X-Files music here, I have to wonder sometimes if these stories and this sort of UFO mythology, Area 51, the Dulce base, if they are used or manipulated or maybe harnessed to divert our attention away from more terrestrial concerns, if you will.
Well, yeah. That goes back to Dulce. If, for instance, the government wanted to test those cows without causing alarm to the local populace and lawsuits and who knows what else, if you wanted a cover for the cattle mutilation episode, UFOs would be a good one, because who's going to bring in a UFO occupant or pilot for trial? You know, so you've got the perfect culprit that can never be accessed. And you can say, oh, must have been those UFOs. Well, yeah, boy, those aliens, they need those parts, I guess. I've even had ranchers tell me that. I said, why do you think your cow got cut up like this? He said, well, I guess somebody needed some parts. And it's like, yeah, I guess they did. So well, anyway, we have that theme. That's a sub theme that runs through all of this. But it, like I say, it does bring it up to the right now. When I get newspaper reports from Oregon, here it is again. In the recent cases, there haven't been any aerial phenomena associated with these cases. That seems to have been phased out. Now they just find them, and there's no footprints. There's no blood in the animals. I forgot to mention that was another common item, that the mutilations were described as being drained of blood. This is over and over again. And now it also bleeds over into popular culture now with the stuff like the Skinwalker Ranch series on the History Channel, which is mutilations were a big part of that story from the very beginning. And I was also into investigating that, the Sherman Ranch, it was called. This is the Bigelow venture that then was turned over to the current people looking into it and doing the show. So it's still, I turn on that series and there's a cattle right off the bat. It's like the X-Files or something. The first image that you have is an mutilated cow face, right? So I'm going, well, I guess this is kind of still like percolating around in the culture, isn't it? So it's not something that happened long ago and far away, and it's here and it's now.
Adam, are you going to add something to that?
Well, that's a big, like Dave was saying, a big part of the Dulce base story are the cattle mutilations, because they work their way into that. And really, I didn't get deep into this, but there was a woman by the name of Myrna Hansen in 1980, who witnessed a cow get sucked up into a ship. And shortly after, herself and her son were sucked up on a, Star Trek style tractor beam into a saucer and witnessed aliens mutilating cattle inside the spaceship, So was this some wild disinformation going on? She recalled these instances through hypnotic regression, which is a slippery slope. So all of this fed into that mystery of Dulce. We talked about Gabe Valdez, a state trooper. He was investigating a lot of these mutilations, and he was seeing strange craft. A lot of the locals were associated with this phenomena, which once again would have been, a hell of a cover story if they wanted cover up what was really going on out there. And there's also appears to be some truth that there at one time or another there was some type of facility at that Dulce base on the Hickory reservation. Was that some type of testing facility for these cattle? That's been speculated and theorized. So there's that. Then just to finish up the Bill Moore at the MUFON.
I wanted to get back to that because I think we set it up. People are probably thinking, why were there people yelling about the Constitution and fire hoses? This is all going to connect together, folks, and this is why we know that there's sort of a disinformation campaign. So let's get to that.
So that's when Bill Moore came clean. It was the 89, was it 89? That's,
yeah,
89 MUFON symposium. Mutual UFO Network, big UFO group, is still around. And Moore basically came clean at that point, said he had this arrangement with Doty and the mysterious Falcon to basically infiltrate ufology. And as Moore explained it, he was playing the game. You have to play the game to get the information, how he never intended to drive Paul Benowitz off the deep end. Moore made it clear. He said he never accepted any money for this. It was just his way of, by playing the game, he could possibly inch us closer to what is the truth behind the UFO mystery. But another part of Moore's message at the MUFON symposium was that other ufologists had now basically became part of the story. John Lear was one, and Bill Cooper as well, who had taken the Benowitz story and basically inserted, embellished a bunch of even crazier stories on top of it that at that point had been or becoming all the rage in ufology that, you know, for instance, all these Dulce Bay stories that, yeah, indeed, the reptilians were experimenting on humans there and even drinking the fluids of children to help preserve a dying alien race. It really, you know, escalated into all these crazy stories that basically took over ufology and upset a lot of the more nuts and bolts ufologists who were, you know, more scientifically based ufologists. And this was basically in 88. From what we know, John Lear Witten visited Paul Benowitz, and that at that point, Lear spent 3 days with Benowitz, and afterwards is when Benowitz really removed himself from ufology, changed his phone numbers, kind of got out of the scene because, as different folks like researcher Christian Lambright, who knew both Benowitz and Lear, something bad happened there between those interactions with John Lear and Benowitz. And shortly after was the release of it's called the Dulce Papers that John Lear had a hand in, that became once again all the rage within ufology during that period. It was the hot topic about this, once again, what I've mentioned before, the so-called secret treaty between the humans and the aliens, and how the aliens had basically screwed over their human counterparts and now were abducting humans and using them for bad things.
And real quick here, Lear and himself, we could talk about an hour or two about Lear, but summing it up for my listeners, and with Bill Cooper, what I find interesting about Cooper is he goes from UFO world to militia and patriot movement world, mm-hmm. and sort of eventually discards all the UFO stuff, says I was tricked, and he becomes very involved in this sort of right-wing militia world. John Lear's interesting for my listeners because his dad, William Lear, invented the Learjet, and you know, John Lear has some unusual connections to the intelligence world himself, or at least his family has. And it's interesting that this guy, John Lear, ends up really pushing the UFO mythology into the 90s, really proselytizing about it, the whole conspiratorial mythology on shows like Art Bell's Coast to Coast AM. Mm-hmm. And that's how all of this sort of goes into the 90s and eventually into the 21st century. It seems like Lear and a few other different characters take the old Benowitz affair and maybe update it for new generations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lear is fascinating dude. And it's, once again, it's like, is he, you know, is this part of an intelligence operation? Or is he just some rogue dude? But he does indeed have a background. I flew for Air America back in the late 60s and 70s, you know, on different missions, Cambodia and Laos and those places. So he has that background. And Lear was also, according to accounts, one of the first people to start leaking information about stealth technology going on at Area 51. And Lear was also behind a lot of these expeditions in the late 80s where they went out to Area 51. He led people to where a lot of the UFOs were showing up at certain times and putting on a display. And, you know, Lear helped introduce Bob Lazar into popular culture, and he has his fingers in the Dulce bass story, on and on and on. You know, he's a key player in promoting all of these tall tales.
And I was going to add, when it came to, I'm glad you mentioned Area 51 again, because I just looked it up. The lawsuit I was referring to involved five unnamed civilian contractors and the widows of contractors who sued the Air Force and the United States Environmental Protection Agency in 1994, and it was over environmental issues at Groom Lake or Area 51. What's interesting is by that time, Area 51, Dreamland, is so associated with, oh, that crazy, you know, oh, you believe in little green men and all that, that no one takes really this environmental lawsuit that seriously. You don't really hear much about it.
It, as I recall, there was some type of toxic dump site there at Area 51, which led to these the lawsuits back in the day. And you talk about the right-wing element, militia types, getting involved in ufology during this period. It's it was much, you know, a lot of it had to do with this fear, escalating fears of the national security state and overreach, and you know what was going on at Area 51 with these Wackenhut security guards that became a legend. And so you had a lot of the you know, don't tread on me type folks that got involved in ufology during that period, once again because of the restricted access to that site. And they, by God, they wanted the truth. That what is the government hiding about UFOs? What are they testing there? What secret weaponry, technology? So that whole element of, you know, entered into ufology during that period, call it, you know, the militia or right-wing element that was represented by the likes of Bill Cooper and others. And as you said, Cooper eventually got away from ufology, said it did, you know, at first he was presenting a lot of the information that John Lear was about all the secret programs and whatnot, but later he said he himself had been duped, and that all of that, the ufological element or the ET element in ufology was government disinformation.
So I know we've gone over the hour here, but would you have a few more minutes? Because there's just two other things I wanted to cover if we could keep both of you on.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So the first thing I wanted to touch upon before we start wrapping up is another character who figures into all of this by the name of Tal Levesque. And Adam, I want you to talk about your experience with him, but this guy is a very interesting character. And I know it doesn't get mentioned in your book, but he was also involved in this sort of character that came about, I think, in the 90s, called Commander X. He claims to have been one of the personalities behind it. And for people that don't know, reading Commander X is a lot of fun because it's like reading an old pulp novel, except in the 90s and claiming to be all the real information about UFOs. But there's almost some sort of like pulp entertainment value that I got out of it. But he's apparently involved in a lot of different literary creations. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about Tal.
And as far as Commander X, too, I mean, there's other people who have claimed to be Commander X over the years. Timothy Beckley has, and also Jim Keith. And it was, you know, Commander X was this whistleblower blowing the whistle on different conspiracies, ufological and otherwise. But
I mention it because there were a lot of this, like, early 90s UFO literature, Commander X or Branton, Bruce Allen Walton, his stuff. A lot of it actually reads as like kind of fun pulp novel type stuff. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think when people get into believing it too hardcore, you know, it can turn into something else entirely. But we don't have to go down that path now. Tell us who Tal is.
So Tal, going back to the 70s or so, was involved in hollow earth research. he and his wife at that time, Mary Martin, put out a zine called The Hollow Earth Hassle. So he was heavily into researching Hollow Earth, was friends with Richard Shaver of the Shaver Mysteries and the whole legends of the Diros, evil entities.
That's why I mentioned the sort of pulp novel aspect to all this.
Because, yeah.
And
that later fed into a lot of the Dulce Bass stuff that Tal was involved with. But how I became acquainted with him, and I write about this in the book, I got an anonymous email at one point from this guy. All the email, the only name I had was the email handle, which was Questal, Quest and Tal. And he said at that time, the email I got, that he was working on a developing a television series about called Mysterious Mariposa, which is a town near me in California in the Gold Country. And I lived nearby him. Somehow he found that out and wanted to know what I knew about any 14 or high strangeness and stuff going on. He also mentioned that he had been a producer for the show UFO Hunters, and in particular the episode about hidden secret underground bases. And I contacted, I didn't know who this guy was. I get all kinds of emails from folks with claims. And I found out, I talked to Bill Burns, who was the head dude on UFO Hunters. And he said, oh yeah, that guy knows somebody. That's Tal Levesque. I said, okay, I'll get a hold of this guy and find out what his deal was. And as time passed, I became more aware of Tal's involvement in these various scenes, the Hollow Earth stuff, and later ufology. And he began telling me basically the story of how he was involved in shaping the Dulce Bass story over time, and how he was really one of the key people in coming up with the whole mythos. He had been involved in ufology. He knew Benowitz, or so he claimed. He claimed he knew Thomas Castello. And it became apparent to me over a period of time that Tal was involved in creating this character of Thomas Castello, and that, as I speculate in the book, that Castello was basically a composite character based on Benowitz and Tal himself, who had worked for many years as a kind of security guard, but he also hinted that he had some connections to the intelligence world, and he knew things about underground bases, and that he was developing these stories at a that time in the late 80s, where he is interacting with all these guys you mentioned, Branton, John Lear, Val Valerian was another one, Bill Hamilton, that all seemed to be confirming a lot of the Dulce Bass stories, but the original information in many cases was coming from Tal. He was passing it on to these other researchers who put their spin.
So all of these other researchers are seemingly independent, but really a lot of this is coming from the one source of Tal giving all these different independent people his own sort of stuff.
But they're, then again, they're independently, or so it appears, confirming the stories he's telling them. So you have all these people now in ufologies telling same or similar stories, and that they're, you know, they're getting them from intelligence sources and, you know, whistleblowers in the government. And that's, you know, that was part of that evolution of the whole Dulce Bass mythos and story.
I knew Tal Levesque, by the way. I met him in early on in the 70s in Santa Fe. And he laid all this on me. This was before the Dulce Bass started to take off. And he was an interesting character. He would send me reams and reams of material about the Dulce Bass. And but he was one of these people that wore sunglasses at night and like the light hurt his eyes. I thought of him as the troglodyte because he was interested in everything underground. I think he came from underground at some point. But the chapter in Adam's book, My Breakfast with Tal, is just one of the best things you will ever read. It really, really gets to the essence of Tal Levesque.
I was going to add, too, I'm so glad you mentioned the Richard Shaver thing, because when I was making the references to sort of pulp novels, I didn't even think to mention Shaver. But, you know, Shaver was claiming there were these underground worlds back in, I think, the 40s or the 50s. And, of course, that was published in Raymond Palmer's Amazing Stories Science Fiction pulp magazine. So that's sort of what I was trying to get at earlier. The other thing I wanted to mention before we close out, so you have all these interesting and odd eccentric characters, some of whom may be from the world of spookdom and some of whom may just be a little bit eccentric or kooky. But getting back to Richard Doty, after all this goes down with Bill Moore saying, you know, we disinformed people, there is a disinformation campaign, and the Benowitz affair basically completely unraveling. And I mean, I think everyone accepts what the Benowitz affair was, that this was a disinformation campaign. Richard Doty doesn't go away. He actually resurfaces. Could you tell my listeners about how this guy resurfaces and seems to promote the same kind of stories all over again?
Well, he does seem to pop up every decade. And yeah, just recently he was on Jimmy Church's show just a couple weeks ago, giving an interview. He really popped up most notoriously after being gone for a decade, popped up with the whole Serpo story, which is kind of a retread of this certain exchange program between the U.S. government and aliens. And, you know, another part of this are the MJ-12 documents, which Bill Moore discovered or had dropped on his doorstep. And most people think Doty was behind that, that, you know, dealt with crash saucers and the retrieval of aliens and
supposedly
whatnot.
For my listeners, MJ-12 was supposedly a secret group that was handling all the UFO stuff, right?
Yeah, and these came out in a series of documents many years ago. And once again, you know, during that period, Doty seemed, even though he always denied it, he really seemed closely associated with all these hoax documents as well. And so a lot of these threads and storylines came out in the Serpo Project story, which I guess was around, 2000 and on the mid 2000s. And they were basically the promoter of this, or the whistleblower behind it, was someone called, what was it? Something Anonymous, much like QAnon.
Request Anonymous.
Request Anonymous. There you go. And eventually some internet sleuths figured out that this was Richard Doty behind all of this. You can read about it in Saucers, Spooks, and Kooks. I don't want to get into all the...
There's a million and one things we could say about Richard Doty. Yeah. This is a guy who apparently went on a TV special, UFO Cover Up Live, and you know he was sort of blacked out. He was silhouetted in this show, and his voice was sort of changed, and he started talking about there is an extraterrestrial biological entity that we have, and you know he really likes strawberry ice cream and Tibetan music. I mean, this dude, he's either working for Intel or he really likes pulling people's legs.
I think a combination of the two. Yeah, he supposedly, he appeared in that as an intelligence agent. He was blacked out under the code name of Falcon. who was supposedly the person who was overseeing the intelligence operation, and Doty was working for Falcon. When it was later discovered that Doty was playing Falcon on the show, Doty said he was just, well, first he, many times he said he was just, it wasn't him, but then later he said he was basically performing the role of proxy as Falcon. So it's all very muddy and crazy, and it always seems to go back to Doty's role in all of these various stories, along with the likes of, you know, same recurring characters, the Talavesque, John Lear, et cetera. It's hard to tell which, you know, are this part of are these government agents? Are they partially government agents who went rogue, or are they just crazy people making stuff up, or is it just a various mix of all these spooks and kooks behind all these mythologies that run through ufology?
Maybe a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, Doty just fascinates me because I'm amazed that, you know, he's involved in this Benowitz affair. Everyone knows he was, you know, involved in disinformation, but he somehow reinvents himself with Serpo and, oh, well, I'm one of the good guys. I'm actually a patriotic whistleblower. It's really crazy, and everyone can read about it in Saucers, Spooks, and Kooks. I guess, in closing, where I wanted to wrap this up, today we sort of see a new wave of enthusiasm about UFOs. I even see people in the sort of mainstream, or people that said, you know, that UFO stuff is that's too fringe for me. Now I see more and more people saying, well, you know, this whole To the Stars Academy thing, and I read about it in the New York Times. You know, I think there's something to it now. Tell us a little bit about your thoughts on To the Stars, and, you know, obviously for people that don't know, To the Stars, I guess its spokesperson is the guy from Blink-182. I'm blanking on his name.
Tom DeLonge. Mm-hmm. He was the considered the spokesperson at the get-go. So it's been, I guess that was in 2017 when they first came into focus, and Tom DeLonge started, for a few years he'd been talking about different his involvement in ufology and whatnot. And at some point, he started interacting with different military intelligence types and people in civilian development of spacecraft and whatnot, and started hearing stories and brought together a lot of these folks and formed this group, TTSA, to basically reveal the truth of what's going on about UFOs. And kind of a
we've heard that line a lot before. Oh, we're finally going to see the truth.
And so he brought a collection of people together, some with backgrounds in intelligence agencies, others who had shown up in these stories over the years. Hal Pudoff is one who you know, plays a role in the whole evolution of a lot of this stuff. He was part of the group called the Aviary back in the 70s and 80s that, you know, basically interacted with Bill Moore and Doty and all these guys. So you have a lot of the same characters once again showing up. Bob Bigelow seemed to be on the edges of whatever was going on with TTSA. And like a lot of these UFO stories, a lot of stuff is promised and never really delivered once the whole thing plays out. But boy, there's a lot to the whole TTSA thing. And
I guess what interests me about the TTSA thing, and I promise to let you go after this because I know we've gone over the hour. You mentioned Robert Bigelow. Robert Bigelow, for people that don't know, is an American businessman. He founded Bigelow Aerospace, which is a space technology startup company. What interests me about all these figures being involved in the To the Stars Academy is the fact that it seems like To the Stars Academy maybe trying to, I think, sell people on certain things with regards to technology. It almost seems like it's a way to sell things for defense contractors.
Well, that you know, is definitely something that Bigelow has been involved with. Do you have any thoughts, sir, David?
Oh, geez. That's a whole other giant can of worms. I say go back and read my foreword for the big picture about the conjunction of all of these things, the defense contractors, the powers that be, the political elites, the QAnons, the saucer believers, the modern myth-making. I mean, it's got everything. This book is just an amazing book, and I really hope people will not be put off by even the word saucers, thinking it's something about flying saucers, because it is much more than that. It is just, and there's so many loose ends still to pursue, and I keep going back to the point that it is still all happening at this moment. All of these things are still in play, and they do affect our daily lives. It's not like something that's doesn't affect you, because whether you know it or not, it is affecting you. And in terms of how money is appropriated for the military and the role that the military might have in the social engineering, just to keep that aspect alive. Oh, there might be aliens, and we've got it under control, so don't worry about it. Meanwhile, we need a whole lot more money to keep you safe. I mean, there's just so many aspects and so many players, and it's so kooky, and it's just almost impossible to unravel it. It really is. I've read this book like two or three times. I know it word by word, Adam's book, and I just keep seeing something new in there. It's like nobody's really followed that thread or this thread. So it all weaves itself around, itself together in some odd way, but it's part of our daily life, and it's something I think everybody should really pay close attention to and consider and buy the book and read the book, because there's a lot there.
I would just add that you see a lot of the same patterns with these stories, and a lot of people picked up on this when TTSA emerged, and they compare some of the characters to earlier stories, like Tom DeLonge. Is he like a version of Bill Moore, a useful idiot, quote unquote, or being used to push this story out to the media? Lou Elizondo, is this like partially a version of Richard Doty to give some credibility or intelligence agency street cred to the story? And the group TTSA was kind of presented like the aviary, kind of a ad hoc group of scientists and investigator and intelligence people trying to bring us closer to the UFO truth, you know. So the same patterns seem to reemerge every decade.
I was just going to add, what I was trying to say about the TTSA earlier is it just seems like there's things like at one point at one of their press conferences, they're really hyping this Raytheon pod and different technology. It seems like there's some sales pitching going on maybe beneath the surface.
Oh, well, yeah, they were raising money. I mean, part of the project, you know, there was different prongs. There was a media thing. That's Tom DeLonge's deal. Well, we're going to put out some entertainment. It's going to be partially about entertainment, you know, aspirational. But another part of it was, well, there's a science advisory board that are looking into stuff. But our main goal was to go to the stars, create spacecraft for, you know, this the next step of mankind. And they, you know, they were actively raising money for all of these projects.
Well, I think that'll be an interesting sort of question mark note to end on, you know, what's behind all these things. Anything else you want to add, Adam or David? And I really like what you said, David, about, you know, I think regardless of what you think of UFOs, whether you're a skeptic or a believer, I think this book has a lot to say about subcultures and about intelligence work and maybe disinformation and, you know, even phenomena like QAnon. Adam, would you like to add anything maybe to that sort of assessment of the book, or how would you pitch listeners who maybe aren't as interested in the UFO phenomena or subculture on this book?
I'm always terrible at giving pitches like that. I think you can make those comparison to modern conspiracy theories and QAnon. That's David's been nudging me to try to do that a bit more. And yeah, you can definitely see that overlap. I don't have a good pitch, damn it. I don't know.
Well, I appreciate the honesty. I'll just say from my end, I think it's a really interesting book that will get people thinking about how certain subcultures can be manipulated, and how, you know, things that we consider kooky may actually, you know, have some impact seeping into the broader culture. And I really appreciate the book. I want to thank you both again for coming on Parallax Views. How can my listeners get a copy of the book as well?
Go to Amazon.com. That's the best way. Punch in Saucers, Spooks, and Kooks, UFO Disinformation in the Age of Aquarius by Adam Gorightly, with the foreword by David Perkins.
Well, thank you again, Adam Gorightly and David Perkins, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Adam Gorightly and David Perkins on Adam's new book, Saucers, Spooks, and Kooks, UFO Disinformation in the Age of Aquarius. I hope it was a wild ride down a crazy hall of mirrors. I think it's an apropos episode for a weekend edition of the show. You know, on the weekends we need to get a little bit more wild and woolly, right? As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Gratz, Brian, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.